Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight where Dr. Jatinder Mann makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's visiting senior research fellow at King's College in London and a former Banting postdoctoral fellow at the University of Alberta. He's currently working on a project, The End of the British World and the Redefinition of Citizenship in Australia, Canada and New Zealand in the 1950s through to the 1970s. He's currently contracted as co-editor of the production of documents on Australian foreign policy on war and peace between 1914 and 1919, which will be published later this year. And he has held visiting fellowships and professorships at the Australian National University, the Carlton University, and the Victoria University of Wellington. And he was awarded his doctorate in history at the University of Sydney in 2011. And today our speaker is going to talk about his new book, The Search for a New Identity, for a New National Identity, The Rise of Multiculturalism in Canada and Australia from the 1890s to the 1970s and other related matters. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, for that kind and generous introduction. And thank you also to Anne and Jared and Nathan as well for facilitating all of this. And a final thank you to all of you, because you can't give a book talk without an audience, but at least a successful one. I really appreciate this wonderful turnout here in Sydney. Alrighty. So, political developments over the past year across the world, notably the referendum in favour of Brexit in the United Kingdom and the recent victory of Donald Trump in the United States, US presidential election, have brought to the fore battles over identity politics. Therefore, I believe it is quite appropriate and timely that I will be talking about my recently published book, The Search for a New National Identity, The Rise of Multiculturalism in Canada and Australia, 1890s to 1970s. So, just to kind of start off with some overarching themes of the book, my book explores the profound social, cultural, and political changes which affected the way in which Canadians and Australians defined themselves as a people from the late 19th century to the 1970s, taking as its central theme the way each country responded to the introduction of new migrants. The book asks a key historical question. Why and how did multiculturalism replace Britishness as the defining idea of community for English-speaking Canada and Australia? And what does this say about the respective experiences of nationalism in the 20th century? So quite a big question there. The book begins from a simple premise, namely that the path towards the adoption of multiculturalism as the orthodox way of defining national community in English-speaking Canada and Australia in the latter half of the 20th century was both uncertain and unsteady. It followed a period in which both nations had looked first and foremost to Britain to define their national self-image. In both nations, however, following the breakdown of their formal and institutional ties to the mother country, in the post-Second World War period, there was a crisis of national meaning.
Hold your paper.
What am I doing? That's okay, Jared. And I'll just take this. Okay, we're minimising here at the front. That's a lot better. Cool. So, yeah, the post-Second World War period, there was a crisis of national meaning, and policymakers and politicians moved quickly to fill the void with a new idea of the nation, one which was the very antithesis to the white monolithic idea of Britishness. At the core of this study is a broader argument about the problem of nationalism and Britishness in both nations, and in particular the problems that both have had in adjusting to the post-imperial era. although there has been considerable disagreement among scholars on the question of nationalism and its meaning, in nearly all cases, two core ingredients are foregrounded here. Firstly, that nationalism emerged in the late 19th century and was primarily associated with Europe and the United States. And secondly, that there was a fundamental connection between nationalism and history. This connection is most often found in the myth or story of a nation, which holds that from time immemorial, the people have been engaged in struggles against an alien other in order to achieve their national destiny. The book compared Canada and Australia because they both have similar political systems and are major immigrant-receiving nations. However, most importantly, English-speaking Canada and Australia both identified themselves as British nations for a large part of their history. Furthermore, this identity came under considerable strain in both countries, a strain that was primarily due to the shock of external events. Secondly, Canada and Australia also adopted discriminatory immigration policies, which aimed to create white British countries. Moreover, they both also gradually dismantled these practices. Thirdly, Canada and Australia experienced large waves of non-British migration to their shores and had to formulate official migrant policies to deal with them. The French presence in Canada was an important point of difference between that country and Australia. It was a significant factor in the Canadian experience of the three main developments above. This was something Australia had no comparable experience of. Immigration, or more precisely whiteness, is also another integral part of the book. Specifically, both Canada and Australia had white Canada or white Australia policies for a majority of the period under study. Whiteness was closely linked with Britishness, as both countries wanted to preserve themselves as white British nations. However, over time, non-discriminatory immigration policies were adopted in both Canada and Australia, and eventually post-white immigration policies were introduced. This leads to the third overarching theme of the book, which is official migrant policy. As both Canada and Australia received non-British migration, official policy had to be formulated to deal with it. Both countries adopted a policy of assimilation in the first instance. This was replaced by integration and then by a policy of multiculturalism as Canada and Australia's national identities were transformed as outlined above. Assimilation expected migrants to incorporate themselves completely into the dominant Anglo-centric or Anglo-Celtic culture in English-speaking Canada and Australia as soon as possible. In this endeavour, learning the official language or languages of the country was paramount. On the other hand, integration acknowledged that the incorporation of migrants into the dominant culture actually took time, usually by the second generation, and allowed migrants to retain certain elements of their home cultures, especially languages. However, it has to be recognised that integration meant different things at different times. So when it was first used in the political lexicon, there was more emphasis on the fact that the incorporation of migrants into the Anglo-centric or Anglo-Celtic culture would take time. Later on, this emphasis changed to allow migrants to retain aspects of their home cultures as a means of enriching the host culture. Multicultural policy instead encouraged migrants to retain their cultures. Indeed, it saw such retention as a positive thing and envisaged that a new national culture would emerge. However, multicultural policy came to mean very different things for Canada and Australia, which are discussed and explored in the book. So, next, just to give you a bit of an idea of the structure of the book. So, it's divided into three sections: Canada, Australia, and comparisons. In the first and second sections, I explore assimilation, integration, and multicultural policies in the two countries in turn, before comparing each of the three policies in the two countries in the third section. This is one of those kind of moments where you have a slide, but you don't actually have to say much with it, so I'm trying to give you time to actually have a look at it. So hopefully I won't skip through it too quickly.
Skip through more quickly.
So, talking about the research process next,
My book is based on my doctoral thesis, which was incidentally produced at the University of Sydney, which was mentioned by Gerard. So it's particularly appropriate that I'm giving this talk in Sydney this evening. So the research process for the book is very much the same as that for my doctoral thesis. This began with a detailed review of the existing literature. As some of you may know, this is quite vast, as illustrated in the bibliography of my book. However, I was able to identify a unique angle in such a popular and well-researched subject. This was, of course, looking at the rise of multiculturalism in Canada and Australia through the British world perspective, namely their histories as British settler societies. In a practical sense, I wrote notes on the secondary sources that I consulted. I then examined both Australian and Canadian published primary sources, and I want to especially mention Fisher Library at the University of Sydney at this junction, as their collection of the former, but even some of the latter, was truly exceptional. And the interlibrary loan section at the library was able to secure any Canadian published primary sources from all over the world that it did not hold itself. As with my secondary research, I also wrote notes based on the Australian and Canadian published primary sources. At this point, I formulated a list of initial primary sources to consult using the secondary sources that I had studied, as well as searching online catalogues. I then undertook extensive primary research at the National Archives of Australia, NAA, and the National Library of Australia, NLA, in Canberra. I was there for over 3 months and amassed a considerable amount of research material. They both truly felt like my second homes and sometimes even my first. It is important to emphasise here that the research process is exactly that, a process. You might start off with a certain number of files, but then through examining them, this leads you to other files. It's like a snowball effect. And sometimes it can get quite overwhelming. But I always kept in mind a great piece of advice my original supervisor, Emeritus Associate Professor Neville Naney, gave me. Always keep your research question in mind. So what he meant here is whenever you come across a file or a document within a file, ask yourself if it helps answer your research question. If the answer is no, then put it aside, as interesting as it might be, and move on to the next document or file. And I can certainly say it's not always easy to do that, but it was good advice. So, I then produced notes based on the primary research that I carried out in Canberra. As you might have noticed, there was a pattern emerging here. Carry out research and then make notes on that research. This is something that has worked for me and actually continues to work for me, as illustrated in my current research project on the end of the British world and the redefinition of citizenship in Australia, Canada and New Zealand, 1950s to 1970s. But it is very much a personal thing. Other researchers might find it easier writing notes as they go along. However, I find it more useful to completely devote oneself to conducting research, especially if you're only in a place for a fixed amount of time, and then write notes on that research subsequently. As I was carrying out a comparative study, I undertook thorough archival research at the Library and Archives Canada, LAC in Ottawa, Canada. And similarly to my research in Canberra, I amassed a very large amount of research material. And also like the NAA and NLA, LAC also very much felt like my second home. Interestingly, compared to the NAA and NLA, LAC houses the Canadian Federal Archives and Library in the one building, and they are actually the one organisation. Although the respective archive and library divisions might not have been entirely happy with this shotgun marriage, from a researcher's perspective, it was certainly quite convenient to have everything you needed under one roof. Once I returned to Sydney from Ottawa, true to form, I wrote notes based on the archival research that I conducted in Ottawa. However, this was the last time that I wrote detailed notes, as all my research was now complete, and I proceeded to write up my doctoral thesis using all of the notes above. This was no small undertaking, considering the scope of the project, the timescale involved, and the comparative approach adopted. However, I managed to do this, and after redrafting, finally submitted my thesis, and I was ultimately awarded my PhD. I had always hoped to turn my doctoral thesis into a book, as I was quite keen to pursue a career in academia. And in my field, having a monograph has become pretty much a necessary requirement to secure a lectureship. So I proceeded to make revisions to turn my doctoral thesis into a book. I was helped in this respect by the fact my original supervisor, Neville, had also given me another great piece of advice. Write your doctoral thesis as if it were a book. However, there were still revisions to be made, and this included reducing the amount of historiography, removing signposts so as the narrative flowed better, and reducing the size of the bibliography to sources that were only relevant to the subject at hand. Quite often in history and politics, you will read books, articles, or scholarly book chapters, which might not be directly related to what you are focusing on, but offer a broader perspective, especially in terms of context. Anyway, once I was happy with the revisions, I submitted my manuscript to a publisher, and it was ultimately published. But before this, I received feedback from reviewers, and I did my best to act on this. One of the main suggestions the reviewers made related to the structure of the book, namely that the order in which I looked at Canada and Australia should be reversed. So in my doctoral thesis, I looked at Australia first and then Canada, as I thought it was better to deal with the more straightforward case first before turning to the more complicated. The reviewers thought as developments took place usually earlier in Canada compared to Australia, it made more narrative sense to switch them around, which I did act on, and I could see the use in that. Another very important suggestion, which was also linked to structure, was grouping the chapters relating to the respective countries together and the comparative chapters in three sections, so a section in Canada, another in Australia, and a third in comparisons, which the book now looks like. The argument for this change was that it would help with narrative flow. So previously, the pattern was a chapter on Australia, Canada, and comparisons in terms of assimilation policies, then a similar pattern with integration, and then with multicultural policy. So there was a lot of moving around between the two. So now to the meat of the talk, major findings. So for anyone familiar with the existing literature on multiculturalism, but even on a popular level, the prevalent belief is that it was Prime Minister Gough Whitlam who was responsible for introducing an official policy of multiculturalism. However, my book shows that it was in actual fact his successor, Malcolm Fraser. At the most, you could possibly say that the Whitlam government laid the foundation for the subsequent adoption of multiculturalism. But the public pronouncements that Whitlam and his Minister for Immigration for most of his premiership, Al Grassley, made were solid integration ones, not multicultural. An example of this is a news release by Al Grassley in July 1973. So I'm just going to read this. I quote, "The position at the present time is that there is an urgent need for a new national effort to build unity in our community, to assist in the integration of newcomers, and to build a united family of the nation through citizenship." End quote. A common feature of the rhetoric surrounding integration policy during the Whitlam period was the family of the nation. This was a phrase coined by Grassley, which has been taken by some scholars as evidence of a policy of multiculturalism during the Whitlam government. But a family, at least to me, implies all being linked in one close group, which is much closer to integration than multicultural policy. So I would argue that what the Whitlam government did do is enable key multiculturalists in the Department of Immigration to attain positions of influence whereby they were able to push for a multiculturalist agenda subsequently. Furthermore, the Whitlam government is also widely held as ushering in a distinct Australian cultural renaissance. However, the foundation for a lot of the cultural initiatives took place during the previous Holt and Gorton ministries and was a part of efforts to advance the new nationalism, an attempt to create uniquely Australian symbols after the decline of Britishness. A prominent example of this is the establishment of the Australian Council for the Arts in 1967, 5 years before Whitlam came to power. Continuing the trend of breaking or at least challenging national political myths, in Canada the first major moves in introducing a non-discriminatory immigration policy were actually made during the Progressive Conservative government of John Diefenbaker in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Again, in the existing literature and on the popular level, you get the impression that it was the subsequent Liberal Pearson government that was largely responsible for dismantling the White Canada policy. And here I just want to point out, in Canada, the Liberal Party there is actually a Liberal Party as opposed to the Liberals in Australia, who are more conservative. However, the Diefenbaker government made some very important moves in breaking down this discriminatory immigration policy. And as with Fraser above, it is interesting to note that these were both conservative governments in the two countries, so not perhaps governments you would naturally think of for doing these things. And another major finding of my book is that subtle shifts in rhetoric surrounding national identity in Canada actually took place quite early, during the premiership of Louis Saint-Laurent in the late 1940s and early to mid-1950s. This is quite significant as the external events which led to the decline of Britishness in Canada, the Suez Crisis of 1957, and the UK's first application for entry into the European Economic Community, EEC, in 1961, did not take place until later. But emphasis should be placed on the word subtle. And in any case, this was a reflection of the bicultural nature of Canada, which Saint-Laurent personally personified, as he was both of French and British descent. An illustration of this is a Citizenship Day speech by Saint-Laurent in May 1950. Citizenship Day had replaced Empire Day in Canada, which I think is quite telling in itself. So again, I quote, "In the past 50 years, there has been a great change in our status. What was then a colony in an empire is now an independent nation in a commonwealth. We have, by Act of Parliament, established our own citizenship. Consequently, I approached the provincial premiers with the result that they all agreed to have arrangements made to the end that some occasion might be found today in the schools for exercises having in mind, in respect of the position of Canada in the Commonwealth, the rights, the privileges, the duties, and the responsibilities of Canadian citizenship. End quote. This shift is noteworthy as the debate was now about Canadian citizenship. This reflected quite well the difficult position French Canadians, particularly national politicians, found themselves in during this period, as they could not relate to British race patriotism and preferred to emphasise homegrown symbols. A further interesting comparative finding in my book is that even though they both use the same terminology, official multicultural policies in Canada and Australia in the 1970s were actually quite different from the outset. In the former, the catchphrase of the policy was multiculturalism within a bilingual framework. So you can get the real sense from this that it was a policy which, in theory, related to all Canadians. And it had come about after an intense period of national soul-searching, illustrated by the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, which carried out its activities over several years in the 1960s. This is highlighted in Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the current Canadian Prime Minister's father, a well-known parliamentary speech on the 8th of October 1971. I quote, "A policy of multiculturalism within a bilingual framework commends itself to the government as the most suitable means of assuring the cultural freedom of Canadians. Such a policy should help to break down discriminatory attitudes and cultural jealousies. National unity, if it is to mean anything in a deeply personal sense, must be founded on confidence in one's own individual identity. Out of this can grow respect for that of others and a willingness to share ideas, attitudes, and assumptions. A vigorous policy of multiculturalism will help create this initial confidence. It can form the base of a society which is based on fair play for all." End quote. Here the emphasis was no longer on the nation, but instead on cultural freedom and one's own individual identity. And the choice of the word vigorous to describe the proposed multicultural policy illustrated the extent of the government's commitment. In contrast, the key headline for the official policy of multiculturalism that was introduced in Australia was a cohesive, united, multicultural nation. Again, you can see here that the emphasis was on cohesion, unity, etc., and unlike the Canadian policy, it was not initially aimed at all Australians, but only migrants. This is demonstrated by the Galbally Report in 1978, which was a major policy document on which the Australian government based its multicultural policy. And this is my last quote. "We believe Australia is at a critical stage in the development of a cohesive, united, multicultural nation. This has come about because of a number of significant changes in recent years, changes in the pattern of migration and the structure of the population, changes in attitudes to migration and to our responsibilities for international refugees, changes in the needs of a large and growing numbers of ethnic groups in our community, and challenges in the roles of government and the community generally in responding to these needs." End quote. Change occurred first in Canada for three main reasons. Firstly, in terms of national identity, Britishness was always a problematic concept due to the presence of a competing founding European group in the country, the French. English-speaking Canada's identification as a British nation was fine so long as French Canada did not have a competing nationalism of its own. However, when this began to change in the 1960s with the Quiet Revolution, it became clear that a new overarching Canadian identity was required to counter French-Canadian separatism. Secondly, the abandonment of whiteness happened earlier in Canada because of the weaker hold the policy had on the national psyche of the country. This was demonstrated by the White Canada policy primarily being centred on the province of British Columbia, compared to the White Australia policy, a national policy that was conceived at the very foundation of the new nation state. This was a consequence of British Columbia as it bordered on the Pacific Ocean and was the only part of Canada that truly felt threatened by Asia. Australia, on the other hand, was characterised by a much more pervasive fear of Asian invasion. Thus, these different geopolitical circumstances certainly go a long way towards explaining why Canada was able to dismantle its White Canada policy much earlier than Australia. Thirdly, Canada adopted official migrant policies considerably earlier than Australia due to it receiving large mass non-British migration around 50 years before Australia received comparable numbers. It had to formulate a way with which to deal with these migrants. It chose assimilation because it identified itself as a British country at this time. Hence, non-British migrants were expected to incorporate themselves into the Anglo-centric culture as soon as possible. So I just want to move on to some of the strengths I feel my book possesses. One of the greatest strengths, and one that both of its endorsers remarked on, so it's not just me saying this, is the comparative approach adopted. I'm a firm believer in the scholarly fruits to be gained from taking such an approach. Specifically, there are several things that would not come to light about either of the two countries unless you compare them together. And through the comparison, you discover what might be unique about each case study and the reasons for this. This is something that I've continued to do in my current research project, as stated earlier, on the end of the British world and the redefinition of citizenship in Australia, Canada and New Zealand, 1950s to 1970s. In fact, it builds on my previous work and expands upon it by also comparing New Zealand, which is truly fascinating. Another strength of my book is the combination of exploring shifts in national identity, immigration policy and migrant policy. Most books would look at one, possibly two, but three is extremely rare. Some would say with good reason, as it is a lot to cope with, especially in light of the comparative nature of the book as well. However, I managed it and feel I did a good job as well. A further unique feature of my book is the way in which it looks at both the big picture, but also political rhetoric and grassroots activism. This, in my experience, is very rare, this mixture of big picture and detail, and I believe it offers an all-encompassing narrative rather than just focusing on one or the other. The book is also based on solid archival research, another aspect remarked upon by the endorsers, and it is something that you hopefully picked up on when I was talking about the research process behind the book. The book draws on new archival material. Previous studies of the origins of multiculturalism in Canada and Australia have concentrated too much on the examination of government reports. Parliamentary debates, newspapers, ethnic and government journals provide considerable new insight into the questions that this work sought to explore. These sources were especially useful in illustrating the way in which ideas of national community changed over the course of time. Another useful feature of the book is that it is extremely readable. I've always prided myself in my clear writing style. I believe it's best to get your points across in as clear a way as possible. Thus, if you do decide to purchase a copy of my book, I sincerely believe that you will find it easy to read and feel that its main arguments are expressed very well. So, it's my last point or section of the talk, which is challenges. So, many of the challenges I faced in writing the book actually relate to most of the strengths I have just discussed. So, I feel that I was able to overcome these challenges and turn them into strengths. Firstly, the scale of the project, both in terms of time period, over a century, comparative approach and the focus on three quite large themes was certainly a challenge. But as I mentioned above, I was able to overcome this, and I actually feel it is one of the greatest appealing aspects of the book, its scope and the amount of territory it covers. The extensive existing secondary literature on the broad subject of multiculturalism was a further challenge, but as I also mentioned earlier, I was able to master this and identify a unique angle to explore in my own study. The discontinuity between the Canadian and Australian experiences in terms of chronology was also something I had to deal with. As I pointed out, quite often Canada took the lead in various ways and Australia followed. So there was a time gap between developments in both countries. However, I managed this through firstly acknowledging that it existed and secondly explaining why this was the case. The practical difficulties, particularly financial, in carrying out detailed archival research, not only in Australia but also in Canada for quite long periods of time, were another challenge. Although I did receive some financial support from the University of Sydney towards this, it was a very small proportion of the costs involved. So it was actually my mother who very generously offered to assist me with supporting myself during my research trips. I'm extremely grateful for this support, but the sad fact of the matter is, if it were not for this assistance, I would not have been able to carry out the archival research, get my PhD, and then ultimately write this book, which is quite a sobering thought, I find. And one last challenge was not only looking at the big picture, but also focusing on political rhetoric and grassroots activism. As I said above, there was an awful lot going on in my book, which was not always easy to manage. However, I did hold it all together and pull it off, and I am extremely proud of the results, and I hope you will be too. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, we have forms out on the chairs where you can fill out and send off to get a copy of the book sent to you on the directions you have there. The Search for a New National Identity, The Rise of Multiculturalism in Canada and Australia, 1990s to 1970s. And so we come to questions and discussion. I just wonder, thanks for your presentation, but I just wonder to what extent the reality of what we're discussing is different from what governments say or the speeches that are written for them, written for ministers by public servants or by press secretaries and put out. We're talking about Australia in the 70s, and I don't know Canada or New Zealand as well as Australia, obviously. But I just wonder how much it changed. I was working in the Fraser government from 1976 for 4 years, and we were all told that, you know, we had this new multiculturalism policy. But after it was brought down after the Gilberley report in 1978, I didn't notice any difference. I mean, we hadn't been a British society in Australia. We'd been essentially a British society with a very large Irish minority. Throughout the 20s and 30s, a lot of Greeks had come, a lot of Italians had come. And after that, the Eastern Europeans after the war, after the Second World War. So when the Gilberley report told us that we all had to be multicultural, the various Italian groups, the Greek groups, the Irish clubs, the Celtic clubs, and the Protestant clubs, were all going any rate. And I just wondered to what extent these policies from on high telling us what we are actually tells us to do something, or whether we just sort of do it any rate apart from the bureaucratic noise coming out of Canberra.
Thank you very much, Joe, for that fascinating question. And actually, towards the end of your kind of question comment, I was reminded actually of the major difference, I would say, between the origins of a multicultural policy in Canada and Australia. And that relates to what you were saying. So in Canada, it was very much more of a grassroots, so a kind of a policy from below, whereas in Australia, it was certainly much more a policy from above. And I think, you know, over the decades that changed. I think there was more grassroots activism involved. But yeah, I would agree. Initially, it was very much a policy from above. And like I said, the Australian approach was very different to the Canadian. Initially, it wasn't, we're all multicultural. Although, you know, I mean, the rhetoric did shift in that respect, but the focus was very much on migrants. It was a very practical bread and butter approach of how do we improve services to migrants. And that's literally what the Gilberley Report, its official title actually contains, migrant services. Whereas in Canada, you had this intense soul-searching during the 60s of who are we as a people. And, you know, so it, you know, I mean, it's debatable whether the policy was truly aimed at all groups in Canadian society, but at least in theory it was. And I think that was a major difference with Australia. So I would say in Australia, even if the policy came from above, in time, I think over the decades, it kind of was embraced more and more, I think, by Australians. And I think the Australians of non-British descent kind of were able to kind of lobby for, you know, changes in direction in the policy, which you had much earlier in Canada because you had mass non-British migration in terms of large numbers at the late 19th century, which you didn't really have in Australia until after the Second World War in terms of large numbers, comparable to the Canadian. So I think that's a major point of difference between the two. So yeah, even though it was initially a policy from above, I do believe that over the decades, I think more and more Australians did actually start to subscribe to it, and certainly Australians of non-British descent kind of, you know, lobbied more to kind of change the direction of the policy, and I think we're quite effective in that, actually.
So we're going to go to Margaret and then to Wada. Can someone turn that light there off? Is that possible? Okay, Margaret?
Yeah, do you want a microphone?
What?
No microphone?
No, I don't have a microphone. Hang on. No, it's off. Okay, Margaret.
Okay, I've lived in Canada for the last 40 years. And the Canadians absolutely kill themselves about what is their identity. That's a big thing about them. And the most common description of their identity that you hear is that it's a negative content definition. We are not American. And I think that one of the major differences between Australia and Canada in terms of forming a unified national identity is that Australia didn't have anybody except New Zealand, and we can accommodate them, who was really like them, very near to them. And Canada had this huge nation below them. And one of the symbol of being not American was Medicare, the national social security healthcare system. So if any politician dared to touch Medicare, there was absolute outrage. And I think that's a big difference from Australia, because Australia's done a lot of experimentation in what sort of a healthcare system you can have. Canada's done none for that reason.
Okay, right, yep.
Thank you so much for that comment and question. And I certainly agree with it. And actually, I'm glad you kind of raised that because, the kind of difference or the distinction between their southern neighbour runs throughout their history. And even going back to the Britishness period, that was, one of the reasons why Britishness was so popular in English-speaking Canada, because they could say, we have a monarchy, we have these British institutions, which you don't because you rebelled and you became a republic. So that was a major point of difference, even going back from, that period onwards. That's certainly, and I agree with you that you don't have that in Australia. You don't have this overbearing, neighbour, which, you try to kind of distinguish yourself from because, culturally they're so dominant and economically and politically even over the period of time. So no, I totally agree with that.
We've got to move on, Margaret. We'll come back later. Ida.
I'm concerned that about your sequel to this book might take a while, so I wondered if you wouldn't mind coming up to contemporary period and commenting on Angela Merkel's view, which she said something to the effect multiculturalism doesn't work, it's a failure.
There's a question about those at the back that Angela Merkel had said that multiculturalism doesn't work, it's a failure.
Again, I'm very grateful for that question. I actually gave a paper some years ago on that very subject, and also actually David Cameron's remarks following Angela Merkel's on similar lines too. My issue with what they said actually was, in terms of what I had focused on in terms of policy, show me where there is a multicultural policy in Germany or in the UK. And they wouldn't be able to because there isn't one. So what they were exactly saying hadn't worked or needed to be replaced, I wasn't quite sure about. Because they do not have a comparable policy, an actual official policy of multiculturalism, as Canada does and even Australia does. You have, kind of some policies on the local level, but it's nothing national and it's certainly not comparable to Canada or Australia. So I kind of question the very premise of their actual statement, to be perfectly honest. And I think, they were perhaps pandering to certain sections of the electorate at the time. But no, there is no official policy of multiculturalism in my first country. So what's failed, I'm not entirely sure. If they're talking about multi-ethnicity, that's a different thing. And I would make that distinction between multi-ethnicity and multiculturalism, which I think quite often people actually just kind of equate as being the same thing, which when it certainly isn't. I would say the UK is multi-ethnic. I wouldn't say it's multicultural. Compared to Canada or Australia.
Peter Curdy?
Thanks, Dr. Matt. Now, given that multiculturalism was originally evolved as a means of fostering social cohesion, how do you think we've got to the point where identity politics has actually led to fragmentation of our society and, in fact, undermined the very cohesion that the original multicultural policies were intended to create? I wonder how you count the move from Fraser-esque multiculturalism to the fragmentation that we have today.
So the suggestion that that identity has undermined the original concept of multiculturalism, the obsession with identity. Yeah.
That's a fascinating question. I mean, I have to say my kind of approach with the book and kind of relating it to kind of debates about identity politics at the moment is actually to kind of hold up Australia and Canada as actual examples of success, actually, when it comes to multiculturalism, compared to certainly the US, compared to the UK, I would say, and certainly parts of mainland Europe. So I'm actually more positive in terms of how multiculturalism has panned out in the two countries. I mean, it's certainly evolved, and that's the fascinating thing. Like I said, the Australian policy initially wasn't really even regarded as being relatable to all Australians. That changed over time. And in both countries, in Australia and Canada, you had an emphasis on the economic benefits to come from multiculturalism, particularly in Australia. We have all these people from Asia that have migrated. We should use this asset. We should use them to develop our trade relations with Asia, which you did have in Canada to some extent, but Australia was certainly much more, emphasized that much more. So yeah, the policy certainly evolved. I suppose the issue now I would find is more in terms of identity politics certainly in terms of Brexit, in terms of the Trump election, is you have a group of people who feel that they've been left behind, that they haven't reaped the benefits of globalization. And I think that's where I would put my focus. It's those people that feel that, and I think actually they're right. They have been left behind and they have perhaps been forgotten. And I think it's the failure of national mainstream politicians who really have kind of neglected them for such a long period of time that they actually now are drawn to kind of more extreme right-wing parties all across the world. And I think, you know, the election of President Trump is a great example of that, along with Brexit, because, you know, one of the main reasons for Brexit was, you know, anti-immigration feeling in the UK, which, you know, a lot of the mainstream parties had ignored, I think, you know, to their misfortune.
And
I'll go back to Jared's point. I also feel that I'm not sure what the chicken and the egg thing. As you spoke, I'm still not convinced that the policies of government brought about the idea of multiculturalism. I think we've brought it about ourselves. I'm much more of the feeling it's a bottom-up approach. And what I wonder is whether too much lecturing from the government brings about a nasty reaction. Because within a few years, or a decade or so, after we started strong government multiculturalism lecturing, we had a very nasty reaction of people arguing publicly against multiculturalism and immigration. And I see immigration and multiculturalism as two separate things. So did this happen in Canada?
Not to the extent of Australia. I mean, there's certainly been debates in Canada, but I don't know who was actually mentioning that. Actually, I think it was you saying, you know, in terms of Canadian identity, you know, it's always kind of the negative. But actually, what's interesting, there was a recent survey in Canada where Canadians were asked, you know, if when you think of Canadian national identity, what's the first thing that comes to mind? And the first thing was actually multiculturalism in Canada. And I find that very telling because I don't believe if there was an equivalent survey done in Australia, but that would be the case as well. It would possibly be in the top five, but it certainly wouldn't be number one. So I think, you know, Canadian identity actually has become quite synonymous with multiculturalism, which it really hasn't in Australia to that extent, and I find why that is quite fascinating. I mean, I think the different origins of the policy have a lot to do with it, but also just the way it's evolved and, you know, also kind of, you know, political kind of support, which, you know, generally speaking, there was bipartisan support in both countries for multiculturalism. It was kind of like, you know, although I think, you know, the Howard years kind of perhaps changed that. And yeah, even since on both sides of politics, you know, there's been, you know, more of an emphasis on integration rather than multiculturalism. So yeah, there's certainly been a shift in political rhetoric, which you also had in Canada to some extent. But I would say with the current government there, it's kind of swing back more towards a active, positive support for multiculturalism. And I have to say, by and large, it seems to be working quite well in Canada. I mean, it certainly has its challenges, but it's been around since 1971 and it's still there.
We're going to Ruth, Seb, and then down the back. Here?
Yes. Yes, I'm just wondering whether your book contains something about First Nations and how do they compare the two countries?
I'm very grateful for that question. The short answer is no, it doesn't, but there's very good reasons for it. So firstly, even though, like historically speaking, you might have had similarly titled policies, so assimilation, integration, they were actually completely separate from those to deal with migrants. And, you know, different branches of government dealt with them. So, yeah, even though they look the same, they're actually quite different. And when it comes to multiculturalism, it's quite fascinating. So that was actually probably the first time I would say that governments, both in Canada and Australia, you know, at least in terms of political rhetoric, you know, try to include Indigenous peoples in both the countries, saying, you know, we're all a multicultural society, and this includes our Indigenous peoples. The interesting thing is, Indigenous people were like, oh, no, we are not going near multiculturalism with a barge pole, because we're the first peoples, and we should be treated as such. We're not going to be grouped together with another 50 immigrant groups that came over, you know, since whatever time period. So then I think both, you know, countries realized, well, the governments thought, oh, okay, we need to not do this. But that was the first attempt to include them. But yeah, Aboriginal peoples themselves did not want anything to do with multiculturalism. And that's been pretty consistent since the policies were introduced.
Seb?
Yeah, I'm Seb. I'm chair of Australian Multicultural Council. But allow me to say that, in my view, Australian multiculturalism is very much reflect political realities of today. It was really born because of grassroots pressure on individual electorates, where you had to have 80 votes to go ahead. Then, of course, Fraser was, as you said, very much ethnic-oriented. Then you've got Keating and Hawke and Keating, which was very different. They were trying to build that national identity, that big picture, and yes, as M said, it brought backlash here. Now, in a way, we are in a very difficult stage because multiculturalism is no longer, as I see it, for all Australians in official rhetorics. Whenever you look at government documents, multiculturalism is much more related to Muslim issues or to refugees. So it's changed. But what I'm trying to suggest, it's work in progress and it will change. We'll see government is about to release new statement and we'll see what will be in it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, when it comes to the ethnic kind of vote kind of link, I'm a little hesitant on that because my view on that is the majority of the electorate, you know, even in that period in the 70s, was still of British descent, or you know, at least large proportions. So it made more electoral sense to go for a policy that was, you know, more likely to appeal to them than even just specific electorates which had a particular high proportion of Italians or Greeks or what not, what ethnic group. But I totally agree with you. The policy has evolved. I mean, if you look at the policy in 1977 to what it is now, you wouldn't recognize it. And yeah, actually, I appreciate your comment about the focus on Muslims and refugees, because I do agree with that. I think that is very much been the kind of... And I think that's where the backlash has also come as well. I mean, look at the rise of One Nation, or the resurgence, I should say. I mean, it's not the first time they've come up. You know, that is something that they're very much focused on. Previously, it was all about Asian immigration. Now it's all about Muslims. And I don't think that's a, you know, that's just an accident. They, you know, they are very much playing on people's fears when it comes to, you know, Islamophobia or refugees, which have been, well, certainly refugees has been a long-standing issue for some time. So, yeah. And I agree. You know, I'm optimistic. The policy is still there. Until something else comes up that's better, I think it will still continue. And what form it takes in its next kind of reincarnation, we'll have to wait and see.
But in Australia, prior to 1976, 25% of the population was Irish background. They didn't regard themselves as British.
Well, I would...
I mean, I came from that tradition.
Yeah, no, but no, that's
we
your...
We didn't regard ourselves
no,
as
I'm
British.
Sure you didn't, but, you know...
We regard ourselves Australian.
There's a lot of research done that... I mean, and we're talking generalisations here. Yeah. I mean, I'm a historian, that's our trade. But, you know, the majority of Australians, for the period of study that I'll look at, you know, did identify themselves as British, and there's lots of evidence to kind of support that, done by Neil Meaney, James Curran, Stuart Ward, and others.
But hang on, there was a whole Irish Catholic tradition in the Labour Party. And you want?
Well, I just want to mention, unlike anywhere else, we had a whole separate structure of schools. Yeah. I mean, 25% of the kids were educated outside the government system by the Catholics, and this is, you know, it's all falling apart at the moment because of the inquiry about abuse of children, but which is historic. But that identity had nothing to do with feeling you were British. You might feel you're part of the British Empire, but our culture was dragged from the Vatican and from Ireland. We had our Catholic history reader from the time we started in school. We learned history through the church. We learned all about saints and God knows what, plus Captain Cook and Governor Phillip. I mean, it all merged. We went from, you know, Saint someone or other who was martyred in the 5th century to Captain Cook discovering Australia. It was a wonderful way of doing history.
It was martyred in the Industrial Revolution. It was martyred in the
18th century. So we kind of merged the saints and the scholars with the founding of Australia. It was the most unique way of doing history, but it was different.
I take your point, but you also had popular celebrations of Britishness. You had Empire Day celebrations, you know. I'm not saying everybody did. I'm not saying everybody did. But we're talking in generalisations here. You know.
Yeah. I mean,
if you look at the First World War, Irish Catholics in Australia volunteered for the Australian Imperial Force in proportion to their numbers.
So they did in Ireland.
And I think that's very telling.
Well, the Irish did too.
They did so, in Ireland too.
Yeah
well, that shows their Britishness as well.
At the time of the Easter Rising, I think the Irish had 230,000 troops in France and Belgium. At the time of the Easter Rising, fighting in the British Army. Anyway, we'll go down the... A couple of hundred thousand. Yeah, we'll go down the back. You're still there. Okay, yeah. Stand up down there, but don't stand in front of the camera, yep? Okay.
Thank you, Tito. That was a really, really interesting talk. But what I'm interested in is like moving away from the Irish to another ethnic group, thinking about Fraser. I mean, that was the time when the Vietnamese started coming to us by boat. And we seem to, not all of us, but certainly Malcolm Fraser welcomed this group of people. And they did integrate into Australia, and, you know, we now have a great Vietnamese population. So having had the government do that, what do you think has happened today with our... I know that's a hard question, and you may not want to be able to answer it, but that's been that real shift, and I suppose we haven't all had answers, that we now have the detention centres, and we have people saying, don't come to Australia, you come by boat. And, you know, what
okay, okay. So the question is about how we've changed from the currents of back in the 1970s when the Indochinese refugees came under the Fraser government. Of course, virtually all of them came on visas in aircraft. They didn't come by boats. But so how do you see that comparison with what's going on today?
That's a fascinating question, Diana. Thank you so much. I suppose the main thing that came to mind is the motivation for accepting the Vietnamese refugees. So it was very much in the context of the Vietnam War. Australia had been involved in that, so I think there was a moral responsibility there. Although, having said that, with the previous Whitlam government, you didn't have high numbers at all of Vietnamese refugees accepted, and that moral responsibility was there too. But the difference there was the Whitlam government was concerned about having a repeat of what had happened with the Baltic refugees. So after the Second World War, you had a lot of Baltic refugees, mainly displaced people, which came over who were fleeing communism, because obviously the Soviet Union had taken over Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And they'd become disproportionate supporters of the conservative parties in Australia. So Whitlam was quite concerned that the same thing would happen with the Vietnamese refugees because they were fleeing the Viet Cong. I think, it was a lot of credit to Fraser, actually, to have adopted that position. I suppose the motivation was different there. I think Australia felt a moral responsibility. You're right. The kind of whole attitude has changed significantly. But I think, picking up on Gerard's point about boats, I would argue, going back to, initial European settlement in Australia, there's always been this pervasive fear of people, mainly from Asia, arriving to Australia in boats. And I think that has just been there throughout, even after White Australia was abandoned. I mean, it's quite a very ingrained kind of, in a way, irrational in terms of the numbers, but it's just, the reaction that I think a lot of Australians do have. And I think that's still very much alive and well, and I think that perhaps explains why there has been such a strong reaction against refugees arriving, especially by boat.
There hasn't been an opposition to refugees. There's been an opposition to refugees arriving by boat. Others do very, very well. There's a question here. We're getting to the end. There's a question there. Yeah. Yes.
I'm wondering what. This is a question for the panel. I'm wondering what the Anglo people who have.
Hang on. Say that again. Yes. Please stop. Yes.
People
go on.
Who have an Anglo heritage in our community. What could we learn from the Irish?
I think I might defer to Anne and Gerard for that one.
Well, be on time, I suppose. Now, if I missed anyone, right down the back. Yeah.
Can I ask that question in a very different way? When you get the question, you realise that it's asking to the other way around. What do you expect to get from adding New Zealand to the comparison you make? If you already have Australia and Canada, we've talked about some of the differences, and we've talked about whether the Irish play a similar role to the French Canadians insofar as they are not technically British, or perhaps they are different roots in a different way. What do you expect to get out of comparing New Zealand?
Okay, so when you put New Zealand in, what difference will it make?
My current project, compared to the one that this book's based on, includes indigeneity. So I'll look at citizenship, how it evolved between the 1950s and 1970s, through ethnicity and indigeneity. Those are the two overarching themes. So, in New Zealand, comparing even on the ethnicity side is interesting, but the indigenous side is truly fascinating because the Maori experience, in a lot of ways, is so different to the Aboriginal and First Nation in Canada. And, there's historical reasons for that. Kind of just seeing the impact that had in terms of, I'm not saying that, New Zealand doesn't have any challenges when it comes to the Maori, far from it. The relationship, certainly has a long way to go. But, sadly, Australia and Canada's experiences with its First Nations, its Aboriginal peoples, is quite similar, whereas the New Zealand is quite significantly different.
Margaret, yeah. Very brief final question. Yeah.
You, in one of your early slides, you used the term post-whiteness. And when we say post something, it means we know what we were, we know that we're not that anymore, but we don't yet know what we are or what we're becoming. So what do you think we are becoming?
Oh my, that's a big question. I think I always, think about the way Australia's changed, if you look at the Second World War period, it truly transformed itself in so many ways. Of course, it wasn't smooth sailing. There were challenges along the way. But it really has become, not only a multi-ethnic country, but, a multicultural one, I would say. And I think that's the kind of direction it's going in. Engaging with its region, of course, for some time now in a big way. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to ponder. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly come a long way. And I'm glad it did abandon the white straddle policy, I have to say, amongst other things. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating country, and I really enjoy studying it. I really do, because it never disappoints. So.
Many thanks. So many thanks to Jatinder Mann for the speech here tonight, an important speech, and copies of his book. We've got references, how do you get it, you can find it on the web and order it there. I mean, someone from the floor mentioned the panel. There wasn't really a panel. Well, there shouldn't have been a panel. But I think I know what he had in mind. I'm very grateful to our speaker today and also to his mother, because without his mother he wouldn't have made it here and he wouldn't have written this book. So I find as a question of gender sensitivity, I noticed the book's devoted to your father, but there you go. And the references to how you order the book is on the bottom of the flyer here, and you can read it out. So, and there's a discount price.
Yeah, 30% off. Which
30% off.
More reasonable, in my opinion.
We're not saying it's off, but it's off something. Australia, I mean, it's interesting to have your observations on Australia, but also Canada, we're interested in this country, obviously, and New Zealand too. So well done tonight. I'm sure you'll be back in Australia because you've got this other book you're contracted to be an editor of on the Australia Virtually During the First World War period. But tonight, well done and thank you.
No, thank you very much. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.